Okay, now we're ready. Thank you one and all for being here. Tonight we're on lesson number 3 as we talk about manuscripts, as we talk about how we got the Bible. And so in lessons 1 and 2, in lesson 1 we talked about the making of ancient books. In lesson 2 we talked about the birth of the Bible, especially the importance of the codex, which is another name for a book instead of the scrolls. We talked about how that our Bible is organized today versus how it was organized in the Jewish Bibles. And we talked a little bit about the languages of the Bible. And all of this is background material, but I think the importance of which will be more evident to us as we just get a better idea. And as we go through the material to how the Bible came to us. The purpose of this material is not to make us scholars in the area of the understanding of the biblical text and how the biblical text came down to us today, but it may give us a few answers when we're faced with someone. I may have told you the story of a massage therapist one time that I went to several years ago and came up in conversation about religion, and I asked her some questions and we got to talking, and she made the statement. She said, "Well, you know, the Bible was originally written in Sanskrit." And I was like, "Sanskrit?" And I'm thinking, where in the world does that come from? Well, after this class, you'll know that that is not the case. It was not written in Sanskrit. I don't know why she thought it was written in Sanskrit or where it came from. But it was written in Hebrew in the Old Testament and Greek in the New Testament and a few Aramaic chapters in the Old Testament and a few Aramaic words in the New Testament. But tonight we'll move on and talk about the most important witnesses. There will be a number of witnesses to the text that we'll talk about. And so we'll talk about unsealed manuscripts and cursive manuscripts and lectionaries and other translations, early translations, and how all these fit together to give us a different witnesses, maybe different strength of those witnesses, but all important witnesses that help us come to a firm conviction that we do have a reliable text, that we do know what the scriptures said then and that we can be confident in them today. There is a picture, there's three. We'll talk about the meaning of an unsealed manuscript if you haven't read the lesson yet. So we'll talk about that in a moment, but there are three very, very important unsealed manuscripts. One is the Codex Sinaiticus. There's a picture of that there. There is the Codex Alexandrinus. And then there's the Codex Vaticanus. And you can guess where the Vaticanus is housed from the name of it. And so, by way of introduction, let's read the first paragraph on page 33. I think it helps to set the stage for the class. So, who would like to read that first major paragraph of the... Mary, go ahead. Mary, I think I saw your hand first. The beginning of the lesson, page 33.
We have seen that the New Testament books made their appearance in the latter half of the first century. These books were undoubtedly written on papyrus sheets, which, with constant use, might not last as long as a decade. So not long after the New Testament was written, the original autographs perished. Yet God's word was not hopelessly lost. The various New Testament letters had been received with the authority of heaven behind them, which prompted early Christians to make many copies of these precious apostolic messages. These copies of the New Testament in Greek are known simply as manuscripts. The word manuscript denotes anything written by hand, but by general consent in connection with the Bible, the term is restricted to documents of the original tongues. Thus, a New Testament manuscript is a Greek manuscript.
And so, as he points out, because they are written on material, papyrus, papyrus, I get those in my head. Papyrus was the one that was made out of reeds and the one that was so easily dried out and became, you know, very flimsy and fell apart. But of course, parchment or vellum was more valuable, more important, as that was widely used much more widely later. The autographs being written on papyrus have been lost. But we emphasize on this first slide that God's word was not lost, and God's word will never be lost. Jesus promised us in Matthew 24, verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 1, 24 and 25, for all flesh is like grass, in all its glory like the flower of grass. The grass withers and the flower falls off, but the word of the Lord endures forever. And so it's the promise of God that his word's going to endure forever. We just make the note that we're studying in these lessons the mechanics of how the word of God came to us from those first documents, copied over and over again. Individual letters that Paul wrote to Corinth or to Rome or to Thessalonica. And yet later these books were collected together by God's providence, and we must never forget God's providence in this process. But understanding something of the process and understanding something of the mechanics of the process does not cause us to doubt what happened. In fact, it just strengthens our faith that much more when we see all these things that happen, God bringing it together, and how we can have such great confidence in the text that we do have. And so we use the term manuscript, and he mentioned this in that first paragraph. The word manuscript comes from two Latin words, manu, which is the word hand in the Latin. We have words in our English like manual and manufacture, which come from that same idea of the manu. There's a lot of manufacturing these days that is not done by hand. It's done by machines. But still, that's where the word came from. The manufacturer is to make things by hand. And so, of course, in the word script is something that's written. So a manuscript is a handwritten document, a handwritten document. But as he said, we use the term, as scholars use the term in this study, in this context, of a manuscript is a document that's in the original language. And so when we use the term manuscript, it's not just anything written down, because many, many years ago, the first translations into the Latin, the first translations into Coptic in Egypt, other languages, they were also written down. We don't refer to those as manuscripts. Manuscripts is the term that we used in this study, in this context, as the Bible in its original language. So anything that's from the Greek is a Greek manuscript, even if it's 10th century, 1,000 years after the originals were written. If it's in the Greek and copied from the, in that process, in the Greek, it's a manuscript. In the Hebrew, of course, Old Testament, the Hebrew or Hebrew manuscripts. In the New Testament, Greek. And translations are copies and translations into any other language. And we'll see in other lessons later that there were many, many other languages it was translated in very early. We believe that there were Aramaic translations. We know that there were Coptic translations. We know that there was Latin and a number of others that I can't think of right now. And so those are also, even though they're not in the original Greek, they're still valuable to us. Those early translations are still valuable to us because of what they point to. How do we learn the age? He talks about this. How do we learn the age? If you read that section before I show them all to you, what are some of the ways he said in our lesson that we can tell the age of a manuscript? One, I've already exposed, some of the later ones even had the date on them. And so those are very easy. When they have a date, that helps. But most of the early ones didn't have dates. So what are some of the other ways, Bonnie?
If they had large letters or small letters.
Okay. Large letters or small letters, and we'll learn more about that in a moment, but that's one indication. Large letters versus small letters. Mary?
Were the words written together or were they separated?
Okay. Okay. In the very valuable manuscript that I handed out to you, you will see that all the letters are together. The earliest unsealed manuscripts, capital letter manuscripts, were all bunched together. They were not separated by spaces. What else?
How many columns on a page?
How many columns on a page would indicate something to the scholars? Bonnie? You notice on this important manuscript I handed out to you that there is no punctuation. And the unseals had no punctuation, we'll notice. What else? That covers most of them. So the handwriting, large or small letters, spaces or no spaces, how many columns, the appearance of the columns, marks of punctuation or divisions into paragraphs. Bonnie? Plain and simple versus elaborate. The use of colored ink and the use of pictures. We notice here's one from the Middle Ages. So here's a Bible manuscript from the Middle Ages. And what you see is a bunch of drawings on there. Now this was very elaborate. This was probably a beginning page or something. I can't read the Latin or the Greek. I don't know what that is. But this was a manuscript. And you see on the left there, Jesus dying on the cross and those waiting around it. Some of the manuscripts from the early age didn't have that much elaboration, and most of them didn't have that much on every page, but might just have, pretty things, flowers, and different kinds of things in the top of the page, at the bottom of the page, in the margins. Sometimes the first letter on a page had a nice, pretty letter, that was painted, the first letter, something like that. And so scholars, again, by looking at that, can know, because of their extensive work in all this area, about what age these were at certain times. There were two major types of manuscripts, unseals and cursives, or minuscules. The cursives are also called minuscules. And we'll talk about the unseals tonight, and not next time, but in a week or two, we'll talk about more about the cursives. The unseals are more valuable to us because they're the oldest. And so the cursive started not until about the 9th century, I believe, about the 800s, 9th century. Before then, everything was unsealed, just capital letters. And so because they're the earliest, then therefore they're most valuable. You want to get the manuscripts that are closest to the date that they were written, that hopefully the ones closest will have the least number of mistakes. And so those oldest manuscripts are the ones that are most valuable to the scholars. There are 5,300 plus Greek manuscripts. That's an impressive number. I didn't find a chart, but you've probably seen charts that other preachers have used of Homer and the Iliad and Tacitus and Herodotus and some of these ancient historians and the number of copies that we found of them, and it's very, very few, 3, 5, 10, 15. Those old books just didn't last and make it. And yet with the Bible, we have so much evidence. This is manuscripts, whether they are, a little more information. None of these are complete. None of these are complete manuscripts. Now, don't let that throw you, because as we will see, most of the manuscripts do not contain all the entire New Testament for the simple reason that hand-produced copies of the whole was too bulky. Remember, we talked about how bulky this was before they got to the technology of getting those skins so very, very, very thin that you could get a whole Bible in one book. Oftentimes, some of the books that were bound would be just the Gospels or just Acts and the Epistles or just the book of Revelation. So they had different divisions that they used of them. And so you have a manuscript, and that manuscript, this may be the Gospels, because that was the intent, that it was just the Gospels. Sometimes pages are lost. Sometimes mistakes like that happen. But generally, you don't have full Bible manuscripts. The four categories of manuscripts, as we said, the way they were often grouped together, was the four Gospels would be grouped together. Acts and the general epistles would be grouped together. What are the general epistles? We talk about the general epistles. Peter, James, Jude, John, the general epistles. James, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude, are generally the general epistles. The Pauline epistles, the epistles of Paul, were often grouped together. And then the book of Revelation, since it was a larger book by itself. Here's a couple of examples. Here's an example of an unsealed manuscript. And so you can see kind of the capital letters on that, even though you can't, you don't know Greek maybe, but you can tell they're capital block letters versus a more cursive style on the bottom side. And so there's an example of the difference of the cursive. They went to a cursive style for several reasons, probably, but one, just speed. As you know, writing cursive is faster than just printing block letters. And so in speeding up the process of copying this material, they went to a cursive style. It really shouldn't matter. That shouldn't change the accuracy in any way. You can copy something in cursive just as accurately as you can copy it in block letters. So that shouldn't change the accuracy of it as long as the scribe is being careful in doing his job. But we just are illustrating the difference of those two styles. The unseals, as we said, were all written in capital letters. The unseals, the words were run together with no spaces. And he has an example, of course, of this in your book. And so on page 35 is an example of that, taken from one of Paul's epistles. And so all the words running together. At the end of the line, a word would be continued onto the next line, right? I mean, when they got to the end of the line, they just went and finished the word. They didn't even put a dash. When we hyphenate a word, we put a dash to let you know there's a hyphenated word there. They didn't even do that. They just kept writing on the next line. And then the oldest manuscripts were unsealed. So this is our oldest group of manuscripts from the 2nd century up to the 10th century. I said 9th while ago, but the unseals continued to about the 10th. I do think they started using the cursive and there was overlap. Therefore, they're more valuable. And they're fewer in number than the cursive manuscripts are. There's about 650. That's still a lot. 650 unsealed manuscripts. 95 are papyri manuscripts. We'll talk more about papyri. But papyri were written on papyrus. So this is New Testament books or New Testament manuscripts that we have found on papyrus. Not written on vellum or parchment, which is the better material. We have, and we'll talk about these later, we have some pieces, not full books. But we have some pieces of papyri that date back to between 100 and 150 AD. Now that's impressive when you stop and think about it. The scholars are sure of the dates of that. And that's important because liberal critics have tried to say that the Bible just wasn't written that early. There was the Jesus lived, and then over time all these stories grew up, and then the books were written. They tried to convince us this evolutionary process to the stories being collected together. But this is powerful to show. The book of John, the Chester B. Papyrus and the John Rylands Papyrus that are housed in England near London. I think it's in Oxford somewhere, but they're housed there. Date back to the early 2nd century. That's really early. We know John was already written by that time, and so these are very valuable. Some are very small, but they're still valuable evidence. Then you have about 250 lectionaries. Lectionaries were books that were written, designed to be read in public worship. If you've ever been to a Catholic service or some Lutheran or Methodist services, there are churches that still use liturgical books. I think the Catholics call theirs a missal. And what they do is they have a book that has, you just follow along in the book. And it has the prayers listed. Introduction, this is what's going to be said. And then these are the songs that are going to be sung. And then here's the prayers that are going to be prayed. Now And then here's the text that's going to be written. And oftentimes the text will be copied right into the liturgical book. These are still used today. They were used in ancient times. Well, why would these be valuable? Well, because of the fact that they were copying from their, it's just another evidence. They were copying from the text that they had, their actual Bible that they had, and they were copying passages into their lectionary to be used in the worship. Well, that's just another indicator. That's just another piece of evidence of what that verse said. And so if they copied John 3:16, or they copied 1 John 4:7, or whatever it is into their lectionary book, that's just another piece of evidence. And so that's why they're called, they're still an evidence of what the text said at that point in time in the history. And so let's talk about these codexes a little bit. These three main ones. The first one is the Codex Vaticanus. There's a picture of it. And so he talks about the important uncials. Look at page 36. Go to page 36. I want another reader. That paragraph where it says the important uncials. Who would like to read that paragraph? Bonnie?
Starting right underneath.
Yeah, by and large.
Here we are very fortunate indeed, for among the very valuable papyri are about 50 that date from the 2nd to the 4th century. In addition, our oldest vellum manuscripts are complete or almost complete copies of the New Testament and have practically all of the Old Testament as well. These old copies are 3 in number and are known as the Vatican, the Sinaitic, and the Alexandrian manuscripts. They date back to AD 300 to 450. Aged, worn, faded, and unattractive in many respects, these are the greatest documentary treasures in the Christendom, the oldest Bibles in the world.
Okay. So they're very important, these three, and we'll add a couple others to them that are important as well. But the Vatican manuscript, as we alluded to, it gets its name because at a very early time it came in possession of the Vatican, of the Pope and the Vatican in Rome, and it's been there ever since. It dates back. It is maybe the earliest of these three very early manuscripts, dating back to about 300 to 350 A.D. It's acknowledged widely as being the most important witness on the text of the New Testament because of its age and because of its condition. It is located still in the Vatican Library in Rome. It's been there since 1481. He mentioned in the book maybe 1448, even earlier than that. But that's a long time ago. That's a long time ago. The history of where it came from and how it came down to that point is a little sketchy. But it's been in control of the Roman Church in the Vatican since the 15th century. It contains in Greek almost all of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, in this case, we talk about this manuscript, and yet the Old Testament is not technically a manuscript, it's a translation. Because the Old Testament is in Greek, and what was the language of the Old Testament? In Hebrew. So the Old Testament, but that was the language it was being copied into. As we mentioned before, the Hebrew had become a dead language, and it was not being used anymore, and so they were copying it in a language that could be read and understood and appreciated. And so the whole Bible, Old and New Testament, were in Greek. There's some missing pieces to it, most of the book of Genesis. A number of the Psalms, about 30 of the Psalms, from Hebrews 9:14 to the close, 1st and 2nd Timothy, Titus, and Revelation are all missing in the Vatican manuscript. It is a codex. What did we say a codex was? It's a book. It has 759 leaves of the finest vellum. That's a direct quote. The finest vellum. Each page is 10 by 10, so you can kind of figure out. I started to make some leaves of this up so we could see. But a standard piece of paper is what?
8.5 by 11.
And so this is 11, so it's just a little bit. Okay, there's 10. So 10 square is the size of each of the pages. But that's a good size page. I mean, you know, you think about something that size square being able to write on. You wouldn't want a book much bigger than that, would you? I mean, we have coffee table books that are bigger than that, but for convenience and for use by people, that's about a good size to have, a 10 by 10 piece. Three columns per page on the Vatican manuscript. Despite what is missing, it is considered to be the most complete copy of the New Testament that is known. A very important witness, we already said that, to the New Testament text. Interestingly, it does not include Mark 16. We'll talk more about Mark 16, 9 through 20, and another time. But there's been an argument among scholars for many years as to whether or not the end of Mark should be there or not, should be in our Bibles or not. And so we will settle that once and for all at a later date. Now, it's interesting, this early manuscript doesn't have it. But what's also interesting, if you read in the book, what?
There's space
that was left. And so that probably indicates that the scribe was aware that there was a question about that, or there was another ending to the book that he did not have, or that was not in the particular manuscript that he was copying. And so he left space for it in case whoever he, maybe this was a manuscript that was going to be sold to someone or given to someone, and in case they wanted to come back later and from another manuscript somewhere, add in that. No one ever did on that manuscript. But it is interesting that space was left for it. Here's a picture of the British Library in London. It was built in 1973, so it's about 50 years old now, is that right? Next year, 2 years, it'll be 50 years old. Before then, all of the collection of the British Museum, let me restart that sentence. All the documents, the written documents and pieces of papyri and books and all those kind of things were all housed in the British Museum. 50 years ago, they built a separate building. So all of the archives, the written archives, the books, they had some very valuable books like the first original Chaucer and some of those. I mean, the British Library has 200 million items. Can you imagine? It's one of the largest libraries in the world. Every book that is published in Great Britain, a copy of it goes to the British Library for cataloging and being a part of their collection. So they have books of every kind, secular, religious, everything in the world, historical from the British Empire. So this is a huge library with huge amounts of material in it. But it also possesses two of the most important Bible documents in the world that were given to it many years ago. One was the Septuagint that we'll talk about next week more in detail, and the other was the Alexandrian that we're going to talk about now. And so this is the British Library. It's a beautiful building. Here's a picture on the inside. I did not take these pictures, although Becky and I were there a couple summers ago. It's a beautiful building. And large amount of a collection space for books and magazines and documents of every kind. And they have a special room. That is not it, but there is a special room that you go to. You can't take pictures in there, but you have a special room for the biblical documents. And so you can see a copy. You can see the Vaticanus manuscript. You can see the Sinaitic manuscript. The Gutenberg, an original Gutenberg Bible is there in that. So there's some interesting things connected with Bible study that is in the British Museum, the British Library. And it's not far from the British Museum. It's just about a mile from the British Museum, but it's a different location now. The Sinaitic manuscript we will talk about more next week. It is called a Sinaitic manuscript because it was discovered at St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. what people believe, the traditional site of Mount Sinai. Do we know exactly which one of it's a mountainous area? Do we know specifically which mountain Moses went up on? No, we don't. But at some point, hundreds of years ago, someone decided that this was the place. And it's been observed as Mount Sinai ever since. And at the foot of that place, there is a, and I'll show you pictures next week, there is a Catholic monastery that's been there, I think, since about 500, a long time. Very early this building was built. And so we'll talk more about that story, but there is a very famous biblical critic, Constantine von Tischendorf, who went there to, he was making travels around the world looking for documents. He was Tischendorf in the 1800s. A lot of biblical scholarship had been done from the 1500s to the 1800s. You can go back to the days of a man by the name of Erasmus, who was a humanistic scholar, a Greek scholar, a Hebrew scholar. You have to remember, coming out of the Middle Ages, there wasn't a lot of scholarship. And scholarship wasn't emphasized. The Catholic Church was in control, basically, of the education in Europe. A lot of people weren't getting educated. The priests were educated, and that was it. They were educated in Latin. There was not a lot of interest. There was little, zero interest in Hebrew and Greek, the original languages. They were just concerned about learning the Bible and studying the Bible and studying their texts and their prayers and all those things in the Latin. But then something happened. It's called the Renaissance. And with the beginning of the Renaissance, after the Middle Ages, and people began to have an interest in learning and reading, and the printing press was invented, and there were more books being printed, people began to have an interest in literature. And about that time, Bible students started having an interest in the original languages, and Hebrew and Greek, and saying, let's go back and study and find out what did the book say before Latin. And so there was a great interest in learning the biblical languages. And there was a man by the name of Erasmus. I saw his tomb when I was in Europe. He died when he was in Basel. And there's a little cathedral in Basel you can go to. And he was buried in the cathedral there. And you can still see his name there, Erasmus. But he was a scholar. He was one of the earliest scholars that was trying to put back together the Greek and the Hebrew text at a very early time. I think Erasmus lived in the late 1500s, early 1600s. Forget for sure, I'd have to look it up, but it was in that time frame. And so these people were trying, and so even by the 1800s when Tischendorf lived, they were still struggling to try to reconstruct the biblical text as accurately as they could. And so he was on a worldwide mission. He visited a number of monasteries, ancient monasteries, where he thought he might go and find documents. And that's what he did. And we'll read the story about it more next week, how he stumbled across one of the most ancient manuscripts that there ever was. So that's a teaser for next week.
Just a very quick question. Vaticanus by B. Elf is a Hebrew letter. Why the difference?
I don't know. They started
letters and numbers.
Yes. Aleph. They started at the beginning of the Hebrew and the Greek alphabet to number these. So they started with A for alpha in the Greek alphabet and B for beta in the Greek alphabet. But then they gave this one the Hebrew's first letter. So they were starting to name them by the letters in order of the Hebrew and Greek alphabet. At some point, they decided not to do that. And I think our author goes into that some and started giving them a numbering system. So that kind of changed at some point, and I don't know all the ins and outs of that. But that's why those particular ones, because they were so early, were given those numbers, or letters. The Alexandrian manuscript gets its name because it was housed in the city of Alexandria in Egypt for many, many years, for many centuries. It was brought to Constantinople in 1621 by this individual, Cyril Lucer, or Lucre, I don't know how to pronounce it, I've never heard of him before this week, who became the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church. Of course, you know, the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church split back in about 600, 700 AD. And ever since then, they have been two separate organizations, very similar in their theology, but separate organizations. And they were back in the 1600s. And this individual was chosen to be the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church. He lived in Alexandria, and he took this important manuscript and thought he would bring it and give it as a gift. And he has more of that story in the lesson book. I think the first person he was going to give it to passed away or fell out of favor with the church or something, I forget. So he ended up giving it to King Charles I of England in 1627, and then 100 years after that or so, it was gifted to the British Library, the newly begun, the British people started their British Museum in 1757. It was given to the British Museum, and now is in, of course, the library wing of the British Museum with the other collection. And so there it is again. And there is a facsimile picture of it. It's a little bit enlarged. You can see the letters a little bit more clearly. This would be a photocopy type of facsimile picture of it. This is the kind that scholars would use to get a very close-up good look to think about the translation. Again, you can see all the letters jammed together. There's a gap here or there, but basically the letters are all jammed together. It has both the Old and New Testaments, again, all in Greek. The Old Testament is 660 pages. The New Testament is 143. It's in four volumes, three volumes for the Old Testament, one for the New Testament. All the New Testament is in one volume. It's 12 by 10, so it's a little bit bigger size, a little bit taller, and about the same width as the other one we talk about. Mostly complete, but it's missing 41 pages of the New Testament. And there's what it's missing. Matthew, the beginning of Matthew down to chapter 25, verse 6. John, about three chapters in John, and about eight chapters in 2 Corinthians. It's dated to the beginning of the 5th century, about 400. The quality is very good. I should say the quality varies and different pieces and different parts of the codex. Someone would say, how would that happen? Notice on page 41 what Lightfoot says. It says, this should not be thought surprising because the various New Testament books at first circulated as single volumes or in combinations of several volumes together, which made it necessary for a scribe to employ several manuscripts in the making of a complete New Testament. You understand what that means? Does that make sense? Let me give you an example. Here's an example. So originally, remember originally that the scribes would copy oftentimes individual books. In the very beginning, Paul wrote a letter to the church at Corinth, or he wrote a letter to the church at Thessalonica or Philippi. So now Philippi has this letter from Paul. Someone else says, we would like a copy of that letter. They really were intended for all the churches. They understood that. And so somebody would make a copy of Philippians, what we call Philippians. And then they would pass it on to someone else, and then they would make a copy of Philippians. And then they would send it on down the road, and someone else would say, we want a copy of that. And so that's how these books, the beginning, began to be circulated. And then they would hear, hey, that church over there has a copy of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Let's get a copy of it. But it had been copied by a different scribe. So you're talking about one scribe did this one, another scribe did this one, another scribe did this one. Some scribes are better at their work than others. Some copy more carefully than others. And so what you had, really, they were piecemealing books together. And over a period of time, because they considered these books to be so, these are from Paul, these are from Peter, these are from the apostles. They've now written, someone, you know, the whisper, they've now written a book on the life of Jesus. Matthew's written a whole book about the life of Jesus. We want a copy of that. And so they start getting copies of these things from different sources, different places. And so one church might have a copy of John or Luke, and later they may add copies from some other source of Paul's letters. And then maybe a few months later, they would get another one of Paul's letters, and then maybe add Peter's letters. You see, so this was just happening piece by piece by piece. And then finally, they would have all the books that they thought were going to be written. It gets into the hundreds, around 100, 125, 150 AD. I think it became obvious to the Christians that's it. The apostles are gone. There's not going to be any more. And these treasures were really treasures, and they continued to copy them and copy them. But, as we said, as in any other process, some copies are better quality than others. Some were more careful than others. And so it's by when they look at this manuscript, they can tell that this was not the work of just one person. This was the work of several individuals all coupled together. Okay? Now, does that take away from our confidence? No. And we'll talk about all that as we talk about mistakes and the kind of mistakes there were. And so we'll talk about all that later. That's the end. And it's only 13 minutes till. Amazing. Amy, a question? The Apocrypha were books that were written really between the Testaments. We'll spend a whole week talking about the Apocrypha later, but that's okay. They were really Jewish books. They were written in Greek originally, I think, or Aramaic. Yeah, I don't think they were written in Hebrew, but they were from Jewish writers. They were like the Maccabees, tells the history of the Jews in the intertestamental period. And some of their poetry books are very similar to Psalms and Proverbs, but those were Jewish writings. They were not quote Christian writings. They were Jewish writings by Jewish scholars or Jewish people during the intertestamental period. Now, some of those books eventually ended up in the Catholic canon. The Catholic Church later decided that they were inspired. And we'll talk about whether or not they should be included in our canon or not later. Most, quote, Protestant scholars have decided no, they weren't inspired. And I think the best argument, I've mentioned this before, I think the best argument for not including them is the fact that even the Jews didn't include them. They were Jewish writings, but the Jews did not include them in their canon. They didn't put them at the end of their Old Testament. They didn't think they were inspired. So if the Jews don't accept them, I don't know why we should. But anyway, those apocryphal books were included by the Catholics, but no one else has included them. There's a couple other books that were written early. One was by a faithful disciple named Clement, and it was included. I think he mentions that in this lesson, that there was, in some of these manuscripts, had a copy of Clement's work in there.
Clement II
or something. Those were later decided and removed from most manuscripts. But some, they're going through a process early of trying to figure some of this out. And we'll talk more about that too, Chuck.
Real quickly, when you were at that British Museum, were you able to actually go in the room and see those books that they had?
Yes. Well, you're not able to go see the collection. You're not able to go up and look through the bookshelves in the collection without special permission. But they have a room that has these books under glass that you can see. You can see the Vaticanus, you can see the Sinaiticus, you can see. I forget what was in that room that day. I forgot. I mentioned the Gutenberg Bible is there. So it's pretty impressive. You kind of get goosebumps standing there, looking at a document that you know was written. It's under lock and key. No pictures are allowed to be taken. They're under special lighting so that the manuscripts don't get ruined. I guess they've scientifically figured all that out as to what the lighting has to be. It's kind of a dark room. It's not a bright lights, but you can see it very clearly. Ron?
Yeah,